Hi, welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfor. We have come to the end of our sixth season and we are taking a look back at some of the strongest, most intriguing and resonant clips from expert guests we have hosted on the show. We have been lucky enough to chat with neuropsychopharmacologists, doctors, scientists, therapists and professionals whose work digs into the deep-rooted sources of addiction, how it affects people, and proven paths to recovery. Most of these guests have their own personal stories, but all have devoted their lives and work to understanding addiction and mental health, helping those who are struggling to find freedom in recovery.
A child will always adapt to what the parent needs without even knowing it. A parent might come from the place of thinking they're really trying to protect the child by not telling them, but a child has spidey senses. Like, you walk into a room and they'll pick up on things.
Yeah.
And if someone is saying, denying their reality and saying that isn't the case, then what happens is you grow up, you begin to doubt yourself because you have these really strong feelings, and yet someone's saying, no, that's not it. That's wrong.
Yeah.
When a child's reality is not sort of affirmed, what can happen is a child can grow up really doubting their own reality. But it's really scary when a child, because you adapt as a young person, you adapt into a way to survive in the traumatic experience, you know, in the environment you're growing up in. And that plays out in adulthood. When you're enmeshed as a child with a primary caregiver, what happens is that those patterns are set up that you're the one, the overdeveloped sense of responsibility.
Yeah.
The energy should always go from the parent to the child, right? Yeah. Ideally, a healthy energy, parent to child. What happens is when the child is looking at the parent and the parent's looking away, and it doesn't mean the parent's a bad parent. It could be they're a single parent, they're working three jobs. It could be lots of reasons. But the child's looking to the parent, but they're not getting that nurturing. So then they look for that nurturing, that attention, in life with other relationships.
Going back to what you said about seeking attention, I much prefer to call it connection seeking. I don't feel connected and I want to feel connected to you.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's so true. I've never heard that before.
You're always going to have rupture in any relationship. But if you're not willing to repair and say, you know what, I hear you, I made a mistake, then that's when the divide happens and that's the re-traumatizing. So it's being able to, as a therapist or in any relationship, say, I made a mistake, thank you for telling me.
Yeah, and that's maturity as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
And knowing yourself as well.
Yeah.
And it's safer because otherwise you're just building up a whole egotistical persona. What is the difference between a craving and obsession? Because I understand that a craving itself only lasts for a short period of time, but the obsessive thought about I need something, whether it's to take away the feelings or just to change the way I feel, is completely different from actually having a craving. And a craving is supposed to be once you start, then you can't stop.
Mm.
What's your view on that?
I think an obsessional thought is something which could be a component of a craving. Sometimes when patients talk to me about cravings, it's a thought, but it's also an emotion and it's a physical sensation. So my view would be, I suppose, that an obsessional thought is a component of that whole experience of a craving. Because the other thing is that words like cravings mean different things for different people. So for some people, you know, they might relate to the word craving with, say, sugar, but it might be what they experience is doesn't have the intensity quite of a craving, or it happens so quickly, like just an urge. They might be kind of walking down the aisle in the supermarket and it's not because of a craving, but something's triggered that urge. You picked up something that was really important, though, the fact that cravings don't last forever. And that's a really, really important point. That we talk about that on the app Curb, that this urge that you're experiencing, it'll probably last for 10 or 15 minutes. And with urges, we describe them a bit like a wave, because that intensity of feeling will grow and it'll get bigger and it'll get stronger. But you have to remember that it will also fall,
yeah,
a bit like a wave. And so what we encourage people to do is to imagine it's a wave, that feeling, but also imagine that you're a surfer and you're going to surf the urge. And so this discomfort is temporary.
Yeah.
If you can just hold on and surf that urge, and it will pass. The other analogy that we sometimes use as well as the wave analogy, is imagining it's like a cloud in the sky. So any of our emotions or feelings, whether they're kind of unpleasant ones or urges, they're temporary, a bit like the clouds in the sky are temporary, and they'll pass through. And yes, it might be dark and stormy when the clouds are there, but the sun is always still behind those clouds, and yeah, those clouds will move on. It's just reminding yourself that this state that you're in right now isn't going to last forever. And if you can hold on to that, then it makes it easier to resist those temptations, those urges.
Do you notice the difference between someone who is in recovery but hasn't looked at the trauma to someone who has?
So in terms of timescale, the Meadows, where Pia Melody worked, they do it in a 5-week program. So they have a 5-week program, a week of which is trauma reduction, post-induction therapy. I have a feeling that's probably too early.
Yeah.
I'll qualify that in a second. A bit further down the line, when somebody is stable, because doing trauma work is destabilizing. So if you're unstable and then you do trauma work, there's more chance of a relapse. So yeah, we don't want that. So, you know, I'm guided by common sense. And there are some people who need a trauma program to get into recovery. And then there are lots of people who need trauma therapy after they've been in recovery. But if you are very traumatized and you can't get it together, because there's a phenomenon, the trauma stuff acts on a bit in your midbrain called your limbic system, and specifically a little bit called the amygdala. And the amygdala is probably the most powerful bit in your brain, because it does fight, flight or freeze, and it has the ability to switch off your cortex. It can hijack your cortex. Now, it doesn't work the other way. So it can switch off your cortex and your thinking goes awry,
yeah,
but you can't get at your amygdala cognitively. So CBT for this stuff is just a non-starter, because it can't get at the bit that needs to be gotten at. So if you're very, very traumatized and your amygdala keeps acting out, then we need to calm that in order for you to have enough cognition to, you know, to do life.
What actually is addiction in your view?
Yeah, there's a medical definition, which is basically around compulsive drug use with the inability to stop, despite having negative personal consequences, social consequences, familial consequences and job-related consequences. So I think really the definition should be broader. I think an addiction is any behavior, not just any kind of drug use or substance use, any behavior that is repetitive, that gives you a level of dependency, and that you will do complicitly and compulsively, and you aren't able to manage despite negative consequences. So I'd broaden the definition out to any behavior. And the reason why I speak more about behaviors now is because I'm becoming more aware that substance addiction, which is predominantly looked at substances, there's a whole class of other addictions, behavioral addictions, which are becoming more rife and more prevalent. And I think they should also be more included in the broader definition.
And what are those behaviors?
So one of the first medically recognized behavioral addictions in 2013 was gambling addiction, which is an area that I've done some research in. But now a lot of doctors, scientists, regulators are looking at internet addiction, social media addiction, porn addiction, binge eating disorder, which can be classified as an addiction, and internet gaming, social media. These things are now being considered to be put into the same category as some of the substance use or behavior, or some of the other behavioral addictions.
Do you think that, what do you think would work for policy change in the UK?
Yeah. So, I mean, the tobacco policies are a really good blueprint. So I think that, so what, one of the reasons we're having this conversation today is because the World Cancer Research Fund is trying to appeal to get an alcohol policy in place. They, every year, the World Cancer Research Fund will do this prevention week. This year, they're focusing on alcohol and encouraging people to sign a petition to encourage the government to have an alcohol policy in place that protects public health. Because at the moment, we don't have alcohol policies that protect public health.
Yeah.
There's like some restrictions on where you can advertise alcohol, and the back of the cans or the bottles will have like a small diagram with a pregnant woman that says, don't drink if you're pregnant, like right at the back. But even that is like, you know, there's still debate about whether pregnant women should drink or not.
Which is crazy.
Which is, the science is obvious, yeah, but there's still this like, well, you know, individual agency. And like, if a woman wants to, it's her body, her choice. It's like, informed choice is not the same thing. If we look to tobacco industry and how policy was came into place to help reduce smoking, and it has done so successfully, right? It's worked. We should have warning labels on alcohol. We really should. Because what I find super interesting, I guess is the word, is that less than half of adults in the UK and Europe even know that alcohol is a carcinogen. So more than half of the population don't even realize that it's a carcinogen. That's so there's crazy. A problem there, right?
Yeah.
Now, I did a podcast a while ago where I mentioned that alcohol consumption increases the risk of breast cancer every unit you drink. So like there's no safe amount. And it was, people were outraged by this. And there's actually, I looked this up, and less than 15% of people know that alcohol causes breast cancer. So the awareness is super low. And I guess this is why we're doing this awareness week, because people just don't even realize that alcohol is a carcinogen.
Because there's something called attunement I do, where I've met people where I just feel healed in their presence because they're radiating love and light, you know.
That's what we felt when you walked in.
Thank you. And that's because I was meditating this morning to connect to, I think everyone's got a radiant scent. I really want to say this to people. However traumatized you are, however addicted you are, deep down there's a central self that is pure love and unharmed by trauma. And that's why I think the truth, I believe that's the truth of everyone. And that's what being in attunement is being connected with that and letting it radiate. Let love radiate without concern for results.
That's really beautiful. But to be really trusting and connecting yourself, I think it's quite a powerful thing, isn't it?
We're doing it now.
Yeah.
By looking, because you can do it through looking as well.
Can you?
Yeah, because if you're in touch with that and you're looking, there's a radiant look where you're looking, letting love radiate out, and then there's a taking look, which is more the addictive look. Well, I need this, or, you know, I need you.
I had a library of things that would help me feel a bit relaxed. And I think I probably didn't understand, I wasn't able to discern, actually, this is the thing that is making me feel really different consistently. So when I studied it, I was like, okay, this is incredible. I'm having such epiphanies. Because here's the thing that I find so fascinating. Your self-image isn't made up of your cognitive mind.
Okay.
It is made up of all your other senses. So the sensations that you feel, and they go on to form your emotions. Your emotions go on to form your thinking, your thoughts. Your thoughts go on to form your actions, and your actions go on to form your long-term behaviours. And this work kind of deals with all of those things.
Amazing.
And that blew my mind.
Yeah.
And it blew my mind, not in a way where I kind of berated myself and thought, oh, why did I do that when I should have done? It was just like, oh, it's so easy. It's
so easy. You don't know what you don't know, do you?
You don't know what you don't know. And the beauty of it is I don't believe that you can think yourself out of a feeling state. You have to feel it. So the beauty of it is that your body senses it first, and then your brain can make sense of it. So what this work does is it introduces new experiences to your nervous system, because how you think and how you respond to things is all based on your past experiences, which is kind of wild, isn't it? although we're always told, aren't we, about meeting things in the moment, and meditation can bring, you know, you can meet it in the moment. Well, I had a meditation practice of 25 years, and I don't know about you, but, you know, it was only in the last 2 minutes of my meditation practice that I'd be like, oh, yeah, I've gone. And all the other times I'd have little thoughts about, oh, the gas bill,
yeah,
or
exactly.
got to get my blow dry appointment in, or whatever it was. Do you know what I mean? So even that, I think, felt like a little bit of a pretense.
Is there a common cross addiction with porn?
That there is with some of the chems, yeah. So I mean, sex and cocaine. We've known that cocaine heightens the arousal system, heightens the experience of orgasm.
Female and male.
Yeah. And we've known that for many years. Within the gay community, there's issues around chemsex. So the unholy trinity, as it's referred to, which is used recreationally by many people without a problem, but for some does become problematic. There's also what we know in working with women with sex and porn addiction, which is a much smaller proportion, but there's certainly a crossover with eating disorders. There's a common crossover with that, but alcohol as well. But one of the things that I see more and more, and I think the addiction community is beginning to wake up to this, is the amount of people in recovery from alcohol and drugs who use porn to get into recovery. You're struggling with craving. You're in the early stages of recovery from drugs, alcohol. You get craving. Look, a bit of porn. It's going to help. And often it's either, well, I didn't know this could be addictive. We have got so many clients at the Laurel Centre who have come from rehabs or are in recovery from other addictions. And they saw either porn was always there, but nobody asked. But since giving up the rest, it's rocketed.
That's interesting.
Or they took it up to help them get off of this because they didn't think it was addictive, and certainly saw it as the lesser of two evils. And if the heroin's going to kill you, let's face it, it is the lesser of two evils.
People seem to think that when you give up drinking, you stop drinking, that you live in a prison.
Yeah, wear sandals and have a tambourine.
Yeah, no, exactly that. But you're fighting every day. You know, oh, they must be going to AA and he must be like really fine. He must see people when they're going out and he must be really like tempted to have a drink and he's sitting there. You know, that's what they think, like people that don't drink are. But the thing is, it's the reverse. Mm. It's actually the reverse. You know, I would never compromise by having a drink. I wouldn't contaminate the power of this by having a drink. I wouldn't do that. People use it to anaesthetize themselves. But the thing is, I look at people now that drink, especially the ones that drink on a regular basis, I see them as being in a prison cell, but they fucking love it. You know what I mean? They love being in that prison cell. And you look at, right, you look at the ethics, or sorry, the principles of Stockholm syndrome, right? Stockholm syndrome, for those that don't know, is when someone, a hostage, falls in love with their captor. They stop trying to assist the outside world that are trying to help them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then they basically form a relationship with the person that's keeping locked in the cell. Doesn't that sound a little bit like alcohol? Doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's Stockholm syndrome. We're in love with this thing called that's really offering us no help whatsoever. And we're not prepared to accept any kind of help from other people that say, just give it a go. But the thing is with telling people not to drink is the fact that you can only tell them so much. They've got to step in and experience it to understand it.
Thank you for listening and watching. We are now taking a short break so that we can look after our own mental well-being, refill our tanks and come back into the studio to record an exciting new season featuring people from the fashion industry. This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation UK, which educates the public about addiction, recovery and a wealth of surrounding issues. We use lived experience and evidence-based science to support those in recovery and those struggling with addiction. To find out more about what we do, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. You can also donate. Please donate. It really, really helps us to put this on for you guys. It will help us to break the stigma of addiction. It will also help us to educate more of the population, and it will allow us to bring you more episodes. Thank you. See you next time.